Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. This holiday season, amidst the buying and the baking, the wrapping and the inevitable unraveling, it's wise to pause and think about others in need. Can be a difficult lesson to learn or remember, especially for children who so easily get caught up in the thrill of paper and presents and Christmas wishes. Virginia Driving Hawks Navy's gently weaves this lesson into her book, The Christmas Coat, Memories of My Sioux Childhood. Now, a new edition of the classic book has recently been released by the South Dakota Historical Society Press. The author grew up in the Rosebud Reservation. She's a member of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe, and she now lives in Rapid City. She's written books for children and adults since 1972. She was one of the first authors to portray Native American children as kids rather than historical artifacts. She's also written deeply and thoughtfully about Native American women, another largely unexplored literary point of view. Virginia Driving Hawks Navy is the recipient of the National American Prose Award and the Spirit of Crazy Horse Award. She's the first South Dakotan to receive the National Humanities Medal. Now, you can see her this weekend as part of a Christmas collection, Songs and Stories to Celebrate the Season. That's at the Performing Arts Center in Rapid City. And she's joining us today from the Black Hills Surgical Hospital Studio in SDPB's Black Hills Studio. Virginia Driving Hawks Navy, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you for having me.
It is such a gift for readers to know that the South Dakota State Historical Society Press has sort of solidified the existence of this book with this reprint. What does it feel like for you to know that this book is now in a new edition and available really in wide distribution?
Well, I was very pleased that it was reprinted. I was very disappointed when it went out of print and was no longer available, and I got requests from many people all over asking where they could get the book, and I had to say, well, it was out of print and maybe find it in a used bookstore or something like that. And so I'm delighted that it is out of in print now, and it's getting a very good reception.
Yeah. Now, you have written about for children and about children for a number of years, and talk a little bit, if you would, about the importance of honesty in children's books, accuracy in children's books.
Well, I started specifically writing for children after I saw what my own children were reading in school about Native Americans. It was a very false image that they were getting. And my daughter would be asking questions about Indians, and she knew she was Native American, but not at all like what was represented in the book, like a very brave princess in Sacagawea, or a noble, a warrior, or chieftain, and that kind of thing, or a very savage type of individual. And so I read what she was reading and realized that there was a need for some accuracy in what children were reading about in school, because children, when they read in school or read anything, they believe what they read that is true. So that was why it became my specific purpose to write about Native Americans as accurately as I could from the experiences that I had growing up on the reservation.
And then there's this element of honesty, which I think so many people struggle with in children's literature because, and we've talked a lot this year about Fred Rogers and how he dealt with the emotions of children. In The Christmas Coat, this girl just really wants something that the rest of us look at and say, well, she really needs a coat. But you allow her to want something and to have a little envy and to have a little disappointment and to have tears. How important is that honesty to really reflect the true life, the true internal and emotional lives of kids?
Well, that was me in the story.
Yeah.
And so I vividly remember that, how I really needed a new coat. I grew suddenly very fast, and mine was old and tight and not at all warm. And my father was an Episcopal priest on the Rosebud Reservation, and we lived in Oak Creek, South Dakota. And we looked forward to getting these rummage boxes that came from congregations in New England, and that's where we got most of our clothes. So I was hoping that there would be a coat that would fit me in the box. And there was one, but I didn't get to have it at all because my mother said to me that others in the village needed things more than we do. And that was very difficult for me to accept. I became rather angry and jealous and all of the emotions that a child can have when they're thwarted by what they really think they want and need. But it turned out okay.
What kind of, over your career, sort of feedback, letters, questions when you do readings or school visits, what kind of things do kids ask you or say to you about your work?
Very often a teacher will be reading one of my books to the class, or it is part of their classroom project, depending on the age of the child. And so then she will have them write me letters about what the book was about and tell what they liked best or what they didn't like best or if they could change the ending. And so I've gotten some very good ideas from children about that. And I really enjoy getting them. Some of them are very frank, saying, like, I really didn't like whatever the character was, and I think you should have had him be a little taller and not so fat, or very descriptive things like that. So it was really fun to get responses from them.
Yeah. And then in 2000, you received the National Humanities Medal from the President of the United States. What is that moment like for you as you look back to how you were, to being that girl who didn't have a coat, to having President Clinton say, this is a way in which we want to honor you and the work that you've done?
Well, it was unbelievable. Yeah. I just could not believe it. We happened to be traveling out of the country, and they couldn't get a hold of me at home to tell me that I was going to receive this award. So they called my daughter Shirley, and she then gave them the phone number of the hotel we were at, and I think it was in Spain. And then I got this long-distance call, and I thought, a first emergency from home and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And then it was from the director of the National Endowment for the Humanities, who had let me know that I had been nominated and then accepted for the award. And I had to be home for it, and would I be able to do that? Well, of course I did.
Yes.
And so it was very unbelievably exciting to have that happen. And then the whole event just seemed so unreal that, like as you said, from a little girl on the Rosebud Reservation coming to the White House and eating there. And my husband and I even danced in the White House just to say we could, because we're not necessarily really ballroom dancers. But it was a unbelievable experiences and very gratifying, and I'm very grateful that I got it.
Yeah, there's dancing in this book too, as
yes.
Your parents are dancing. Some sort of this moment where that is a blush-worthy dancing, because they're kind of caught in
yeah.
One of those. Tell us a little bit about that perfect family, because I think anybody who's had a father that they looked up to and admired the great silliness of dads. Tell us a little bit about the dancing in the Christmas Coat book.
Well, we got to go into the rummage room and pick out stuff for ourselves. And my mother found this nice, funny-looking dress, but we got really weird things in these boxes from the East, not very practical clothing. But anyway, I put on something, and then my dad found this corset. Now, very few children today, or maybe many adults, don't know what a corset is. We don't wear those things anymore. But it's an undergarment that fits tightly to hold your fat rolls in. And my father found this and put it on. Then he started twirling us around, and we were dancing. And a woman from the congregation came into the door and saw us and said, oh. She was just horrified to think that we were dancing like that. She didn't think a minister should be behaving like that at all.
And that's, he's a minister, but he's also just your dad.
Yes, that's right.
You have written so much about the and spoken about the role of grandmothers, the role of women, storytelling. You have this wonderful book called Sioux Women, Traditionally Sacred, which I just treasure my copy of. And talk to us a little bit for people on the radio about, was it hard to convince publishers or editors? Because again, this is another area where, you know, there just wasn't a lot of literature that depicted Native American women as real people or at all.
Yes.
Was it a hard sell?
Well, I started writing about women, in a sense, for the University of Nebraska Press. They put out a call for a nonfiction book written by a Native American because we were underrepresented in publishing, period. And so I had been doing some research on women for something I'd done at it for some sort of a symposium. Can't remember exactly what it was now. So I thought, well, yeah, I'll do this about women. And the research I had done just seemed so academic that I knew that it would not be a very good book written so dry like that. So then I took the facts and the research and put it in context of the oral history that I had of from my mother and my grandmothers, so that I think it became a more readable book. And then South Dakota State Historical Society Press approached me about doing a book about Sioux women specifically in South Dakota, which was delightful to have that opportunity to do. So I really did not have to twist many arms at all to do this. Now, in the editing process, I did have to hold my ground because some things the editors didn't think sounded the way they thought women should be. So that is where the conflict came in a little bit. But otherwise, I was approached to do the books.
Can you think of an example of something that caught their attention that they wanted to double check with you?
Well, and particularly incidents in the boarding schools.
Oh,
how the children were taken away at a very young age. And so that my grandmother told these stories of how they would be taken in the first night in the dormitories. It would be very dark and quiet, and all these little girls would be there, and they'd start crying. And then what the woman who was overseeing the dormitory, they called her a matron, would come stomping in and was really, according to my grandmother, was very cruel in how she disciplined the children. And the editor thought, oh, no, nobody would be that cruel to children. And I had to insist, yes, that was how they were treated. They were expected to just conform exactly to what the white matron and teachers and educators thought they should be as they were being educated. And they're not allowed to use their language and give up their culture entirely. But that was definitely how it was.
Hmm. So much riding on that decision of yours, that ability that you had to hold to the truth, so many other people's stories that you're telling there. You grew up with these, you know, the oral tradition, the family stories, legends and myths, all kind of woven in, and then you fall in love with books as well. How
Yes.
do you see your role as a writer and as a teacher, but also as a storyteller? Is it seamless for you, or do you feel like you have to switch between different?
No, it's just a transition, I think, from being an oral storyteller to writing and using words. The spoken word, as my grandmother would tell stories to us, and her facial expressions and her hand motions and that kind enhanced the story as she was telling it. So the words she used orally created pictures in my mind. And I tried to do that with the written word to create the story so that it would become very visible in a child's mind, and not just trying to really show them what it was like instead of just telling them what it was.
Yeah, you are a national treasure and someone that we are so very grateful to get to talk to. I think I've mentioned this to you before. We only have about 30 seconds left, but I've never been able to interview you, and part of it is because I've always been kind of intimidated.
Oh, no.
Not through anything that you've done, but just because that my connection with your work is so deep that, you know, that's hard for me to express in words. So thank you for your time here today.
Well,
really.
Thank you so much for having me, and I certainly hope I don't intimidate
no.
anybody.